This is the fifth session of a series, although the series was interrupted by not meeting yesterday, and is interrupted also in a sense formally by having a different kind of theme. The series is called The Theology of Peacemaking. It's appropriate to take a look back over the week. I said we were talking about theology in the strong sense, that is, concern about the nature and will of God, not reducing the discussion of peace, as one so often can, to semantic discussions about what do you mean by justice, what do you mean by violence, or strategy calculations about what's the best way to respond to the Russians, or what's the likelihood that one political strategy or another will pay off. Whatever we think about those important questions, we have to start with the Christian message that God is a peacemaking God. Then we looked at three figures: the Russian storyteller, Tolstoy, noting the difference that it made to his understanding of these matters that he was a convert, that in adult life, he radically changed the direction of his life, and that what made him do that was a very simple but fundamental understanding that there is such a thing as moral obligation, as law, and that regardless of the possibilities of dealing wrongly with law, the dangers of legalism and rigidity, we do need to be told. And Jesus did tell us some things, specifically about loving the enemy, which had a hold on Tolstoy because of the nature of his own conversion experience. We looked then at Gandhi, who himself had learned from Tolstoy and other Western Christian writers, noted his accentuating the power of truth. The reason for nonviolent action is not that it coerces people, but that it opens their mind to the truth. And his insistence on the dignity of the other party. We don't just want to save the victims from oppression. We want to save the oppressor from the evil of being an oppressor. Then we looked at Martin Luther King, saw how he took some of that same wisdom and some of the same strategies that Gandhi had used, but made it authentically American and authentically rooted it in the black religious experience. Now the title, which was suggested at the beginning of the week for this evening, is Where Do We Go From Here? We shouldn't use a phrase like where that we can go on from with some simple vision of progress. American society as a whole is behind where it was when King was assassinated in terms of both the rights and the general prosperity level of most of the minorities, including the blacks. Any formative experience which makes a big impact on the people as a whole is lost if in 15 years it isn't renewed. I have observed in teaching undergraduates at the University of Notre Dame a very clear threshold within the last 3 or 4 years. Just before that, most of the students in a class would remember when King was assassinated. It was a marked event. It made for riots in some cities and other kinds of attention in others. They knew at least that much. And now, undergraduates are coming onto the campuses whose mind doesn't go back that far. And in that same sense, we aren't able to move on in any sense of progress. And yet there is some accumulation of wisdom on the part of those who have learned some things in that process, so that it's still appropriate to ask as if we were, or as if some people were, or as if somehow the mind of the Christian community were, after having learned what there was to learn with and from King, ready to learn something more. Other Issues, Other Persons was the subtitle that Larry announced. There are other people. There are other movements. The bookstore has, I think, yet, or at least did have a couple days ago, a copy of this book, which is a good compendium, Marjorie Hope and James Young traveled around interviewing people, looking them up in their local context, not only North America, but around the world, and report on half a dozen major figures, some of them the founders of movements, like the Italian Gandhian, Lanza del Vasto, or the Sicilian or Italian architect who's now in Sicily, Danilo Dolci, also the American Chicano, Cesar Chavez. There are numerous people who have gone on from King in that sense. They have found other ways in which nonviolent participation in change process can happen. It needs to be led. It needs to be adjusted to different situations. But it can be. Each of these persons has a specific kind of flair, creativity. They differ from one another in numerous details. But they have in common that they have found creative modes of nonviolent action in the interest of this or that particular concern for human justice. Subtitle, Agents of Nonviolent Change in a Violent World. There is one person who is actually, or was, when the book was written, a little on the edge of their judgment of whether he belonged in the book, because he's in active government and one-party politics, Kenneth Kaunda. All of the other people can be described as literally nonviolent in their thought and action. Almost all of them Christian, not quite all. There are also Buddhist specimens. I can't try to capsule those cases, but just to point to that phenomenon. There are numerous people going on to do on behalf of other population groups around other causes, creative new ways of working for change in the direction of greater justice. And that kind of thing is just the kind of thing that journalistically sensitive people could look up 10 years ago when they did the research for that book. It's still going on. There has been a chain of very effective non-cooperation movements led by women in South Africa. Years ago already, the wives of miners in Peru, and more recently also in Bolivia. Those of us who were at the World Council of Churches 10 days ago heard the testimony of one of the women who had mobilized such a nonviolent campaign when their husbands couldn't, with regard to basic labor rights. We had with us here until the day before yesterday a Brazilian Lutheran, a layman and his wife, and he commented on the importance of what's going on in Argentina, where for numerous years, not only agents of the government itself, which is a military dictatorship, but also right-wing freelance groups have been disappearing people. They have made the verb disappear into a transitive verb. People get disappeared. That is, no one knows, there is no legal status to their being detained, and usually they're presumed dead. The mothers and widows of these men have been meeting in the main square in downtown Buenos Aires in Argentina every Thursday afternoon for years. And according to this brother from Brazil, that's one of the major reasons that the military regime has lost credibility and is permitting movement in the direction of a little less repression. Of course, they're losing the Falkland. Malvinas War is another reason. Another category of that, and be the last one I'd mention now, you may want to come back to it at the end of the hour, is the increasing visibility of anti-nuclear civil disobedience. Here in the Northwest, we're especially aware of both James Douglas, the Catholic, and John Nelson, the Lutheran, with regard to the nuclear escalation, as symbolized especially around Seattle by the large air and Navy establishments. Europe is seeing more of these things. Right now there's a very strong women's movement in England camping around the major nuclear installations. There has been a smaller number of people with more dramatic acts of civil disobedience, especially the Kerrigans, with the action of King of Prussia in a missile nose cone factory some time ago. These are different styles, different levels, different objectives, but the linkage of concern to make peace with creative ways of making for change rather than just letting things be as they are is represented by all of these. So there are leaders and movements. Secondly, to look off in another direction, what I would call as a general title, social science creativity. If it is the case, as we can now say, on the basis of experiences, especially of the last century, especially as represented by these leaders, that nonviolent action for social change is possible, then it ought to be something that could be studied by social scientists. And one could learn how better or less well to do it. One could learn what the lessons are, what the tactics and techniques are, instead of it being just a matter of creative ingenuity and great leadership and a certain artistic flair on the part of somebody like Gandhi or King. Maybe we could think about it systematically. There has been developing over the past 20 years a new field of social science called conflict resolution, which has its own journals, its scientific methods, its ways of using game theory and statistics, its ways of reading history, its scholarly conferences, and all the rest of the paraphernalia that it takes for a science to be respectable. There is also a development of conflict resolution as a skill, as a technique, as something that you can learn to do and then go out to get a job doing. There are agencies that are ready for creative reconciling intervention in cases of certain kinds of social conflict. There are people that are on call to mediate industrial disputes, product quality disputes, public school racial segregation disputes. There are ways that are better than others, and you can learn which ones are better for conflict management. Beyond this, there is the growing edge of what you would do about the problems that people usually do resolve militarily. Would there be such a thing as nonviolent peacekeeping between nations or between groups of major groups of people? For something like 5 years, the United Nations kept a peaceable line across Cyprus. They had soldiers there, but they were ordered never to shoot. And they didn't. And they didn't have to. Later that broke down because the unstable peace between the Turks and the Greeks was not deepened, was not really reconciled. Nobody really did any creative statesmanship. But for a long time, an unarmed presence of disciplined people with orders not to shoot was able to keep the peace. That's not quite not military. They were people in uniform. But the orders they were under were orders not to shoot, and they obeyed those orders, and they were able to keep the peace. Going beyond that, there is a rising wave of creative projecting, scenario building, about the possibility of nonviolent national defense, or as some say, civilian-based national defense. This kind of thought goes back farther in some circles, but in serious non-pacifist political circles, it was kicked off by a British military scientist, Commander Stephen King Hall, himself a high naval officer, were taught in both the Army and the Navy war colleges in the Second World War, and in fact was so respected that he ran a newsletter of his own with weekly editions going out to military thinkers. The week after Hiroshima, he wrote in his newsletter that this event has changed the face of modern war. From now on, we cannot responsibly have another all-out war. Now, he was no pacifist. He was a hard-nosed military calculator, saying that these new weapons are going to make it no longer possible for war to be what war is supposed to be, an instrument of rational national policy. And it can't anymore. So we'll need to find a way to defend what we want to defend, namely democracy, by means which don't destroy us in the act of defending. So by 1958, he had a book out saying that, Defense in a Nuclear Age. That's before a lot of people thought about these kinds of things. But that line of thought is developing still further. Harvard doctoral dissertation by Gene Sharp has spread that kind of thought much more widely, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, although Sharp is not interested only in defending national values. It is the claim that one can do so, that there are more means than you thought to defend national values without violence. The kinds of violence we now have with the escalation of modern weapons are less and less usable for any rational purpose. Therefore, on the trade-off, the case for nonviolent national defense is getting increasingly strong. And the last place I'd point to, which is a different kind of source and therefore shows an entering into a wider circle of discourse, Ronald Sider and Richard Taylor, a book called Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope. It's in the bookstore. In fact, this is a bookstore copy. Where most of the book is talking about other things, but there are three chapters toward the back asking, is non-military defense possible? Ron Sider is more widely known as organizer of a group called Evangelicals for Social Action, having written in the field of world hunger and other matters of violence, but this is the first time he's tried to pull something together on the level of a national defense policy and strategy that would not use violence. It's based on Sharp and King Hall and half a dozen other people of the same type who, on non-pacifist, pragmatic grounds, say, if we have something that we want at all costs to defend, we'll have to find a way to defend it without escalating modern weapons. Now, many people would say that would include keeping conventional weapons. The people I'm talking about now doubt that even non-nuclear weapons can be used without more destruction than what they can claim to defend. These scenarios are based on anecdotes over the centuries of people who have defended certain values nonviolently, but of course they extrapolate beyond those anecdotes. There never has been an effort consciously at nonviolent national defense, but that's really not much of a disadvantage. There hasn't ever been a nuclear war either, and yet we spend a lot of time thinking about how we're going to do that as if we knew and as if we could manage. So it is a creative scenario building that is worthy of much more attention than it gets, but is getting more attention than it has in the past. Beyond social science, in the sense of patterns of analysis that try to be rigorous and quantifiable and to project with some firmness, there's another level that's harder to talk about abstractly, would need to be processed and practiced another way. We've had in our camp curriculum this week two sessions on imaging a world without war, pointing to the extent to which what we try to do reasonably, organizationally, institutionally, to hold the world together, is the surfacing of much deeper matters of style, culture, character, personality. Lifestyle, mode of seeing people. And that if we are interested in joining God in peacemaking in the real world, it won't just be a matter of adjusting our techniques to be less lethal, but remodeling our attitudes, to think of others, think of enemies no longer as enemies, or those who really are in some sense our adversaries, think even of them in their humanity and in the dignity that God gives them, even if they are threatening us. And very often they're not threatening us the way some people tell us they are. Now, to come back to this notion of nonviolent action as an alternative to war, I've just said it's been talked about, it's there in the literature, and I won't try to summarize that literature, but to think about what it means, what difference it makes if one could contemplate defending important national values by other means than war. Two very different specimens from history that I've referred to before. I didn't think them up, I got them from historians. That doesn't prove they're the right way to read the history. An old story and a more recent one. The original inhabitants of North America faced the European invasion slowly. That is, it took the people from Europe over a century, two centuries, to get from the East Coast to the West Coast. During that time, it was possible for the Indians to get guns, to play the British and the French off against each other, so they could try to fight back against the white man with the white man's weapons. And they lost, and were pushed westward and pushed into tiny reservations and pushed to nearly the brink of loss of cultural identity. The Indians south of the Rio Grande weren't able to stop the Europeans. The Europeans swept over them much more rapidly, partly because they were more brutal, partly because the cultural difference was differently structured. The Spanish and the Portuguese colonists took over the whole continent in a very short time. They destroyed the high civilizations of the Incas and the Mayas, but they didn't destroy Indian culture. And the Indian culture of what we now call Latin America is more authentically present even within Catholicism, which swallowed it or took it up rather than destroying it. It is the way to save a culture is not necessarily to win wars with it, and especially not to fight wars in the enemy's terms. What saved such Indian civilization as there is in the South was the fact that they didn't win their wars, but they became subjects, but they survived. Whereas in the North, they tried to fight, they even won some of their wars, but they lost what they were trying to defend in so doing. The more recent story was exemplified by the behavior of Norway. Norway was occupied. There were within Norway collaborators who worked with the Nazis to try to get that occupation accepted. But Norway is still Norway. If there had been a battle at every village with much more bloodshed, and if there hadn't been nonviolent resistance, strikes, and non-cooperation campaigns, we don't know what there would have been. But it is possible to lose a military war and save one's civilization. It's that kind of specimens that these scenario builders work with. In Hungary in 56, there was first of all a violent uprising, which had been planned for years, which had deep popular support, and in 4 days it was smashed. Then there was a general strike, which hadn't been planned for, which nobody had prepared to coordinate, which had no network for thinking about how to carry it on. And it stymied the Russians for 6 weeks. If the same amount of planning, the same amount of money, the same amount of development, of management, leadership style, had gone into planning for the general strike in the first place, and the Russians had never been given a pretext to bring their tanks into Budapest, we don't know what would have happened to the Hungarian Revolution. I say those things negatively because we can't have a positive scenario. It's never worked on that scale, but it's thinkable. And the worse the weapons of outright war get, the more we know about what has been done by nonviolent tactics, the more we have to think of these matters. Now, the narrowest way to look at this question would be as a part of a debate between pacifists and non-pacifists, in which the pacifists would say, see, after all, we can save what you want to save without bloodshed, without as much bloodshed, without organized, mechanized, technological bloodshed, and that it is appropriate that that's part of that argument. So that some of the people who say there would be non-violent techniques of national defense are pacifists. But most of them aren't. Most of them are non-pacifists who just say that it's a more rational way to defend anything that can possibly be defended against an adversary, assuming you have an adversary who wants to take it away from you. But seeing this question in the line of the pacifist-non-pacifist debate is to make it too narrow. The other major Christian view about war, the just war tradition, also says you must minimize damage, that you must use only that amount of violence which is a last resort and which is likely to work to save a just cause in the name of a legitimate authority. That is the classic tradition, which if you are a Lutheran, you're supposed to have been taught in your catechism, because it's in Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession, says that most wars are not justified. That's what the tradition in its logic says. Only those that meet certain requirements, and the others shouldn't be fought. So that you don't have to be a pacifist to care about what you can defend nonviolently. The pacifist is not obligated to prove that he can save a society, because very often the pacifist is not very enthusiastic about the society other people want to save, and his criterion for discipleship, if he's like Tolstoy or if he's like Quakers or Mennonites in the past, wasn't that you have to be able to save a country anyway. A war doesn't save countries either. So that it isn't really a question, mostly, about whether the pacifist position is credible. It's a common search for the least destructive ways possible to safeguard or to defend or to advocate whatever morally important social cause we're interested in. To reject violence is not to be cowardly, but to be more courageous and creative. It doesn't take much creativity to use a gun. It takes courage to use a gun when the other guy has one. But it takes even more courage not to use a gun when the other guy has one. Cesar Chavez says something like that. When you have a great moral advantage when you don't have a gun and the other person does. He has a decision to make and you don't. It is, it isn't the case that most people who argue for nonviolent tactics are less interested in being involved or responsible or creative or risk-taking than those who assume that violence is going to be the answer. We shouldn't focus on the experience that most of us can look back on, that is the American civil rights experience, as if it were the only specimen of this kind of concern for loving the enemy, loving the adversary, and peacemaking as God's purposes. In the 60s, a good bit of that action was not very creative. They learned that if you want to desegregate a lunch counter, because it's wrong to have lunch counters that won't serve black people, a very appropriate way to do it is to sit in it. So people started doing sit-ins. And if what you wanted is to desegregate a lunch counter, a sit-in is a very appropriate, symbolic, dramatic, effective action. But then they started sitting in university presidents' offices for other purposes. And the different kinds of tactics weren't artistically apt to the symbolism that they wanted to save. Or there was a time when some people in New York disapproved of the tactics of the school board, so they sat on the Triborough Bridge. And the people whom they kept from going across the bridge had nothing to do with the school board. So there was a degeneration in the aptness of the symbolic action, which made that kind of thing less and less original and less credible. So instead of saying King did something but he didn't get everything done, instead of asking whether those tactics would do all kinds of things, we need rather to step back and start with what I call the theology. Are we committed to the dignity of the adversary, that is, to the image of God in the other person in a conflict? And even if that person is evil, or even if that person is, from our perspective, pursuing the wrong goals, is that still a human being whom I'm called upon, in secular terms because it's a fellow human being, in Christian terms because of the image of God and the model of Jesus, to love? If so, we'll need to find ways to deal with our conflict that express that respect. I suspect that it's best to stop there. Some of you weren't in the rest of the week, and we will need to take the time to get our conversation started just from what I've said here. Those of you who were here for the earlier part of the week, feel free to bring in from then anything more that you think bears on this. Could maybe segregate in three areas the things I've pointed to. One is, from here, there is a movement going on in more kinds and styles of nonviolent action. There is a broadening of the agenda, looking now specifically at whether the possibility of nonviolent national defense or civilian-based national defense is thinkable as a response to the great fears of our age. And looking back to the more theological questions, what does it say about our capacity, our readiness to love our enemies, that these tactics have come into being in our century and have had some degree, a modest degree, of effectiveness and earned a degree of credibility as data in social science and social process? Now, you may want to follow any one of these things. They're all different. I don't claim they're three parts of the same question. There are different ways to move off from where we were in the earlier part of the week. So it's up to you to ask which way you want to lead us from here.
Yeah, I have something. This has kind of been in my mind for the last two nights. And your remark, you made a remark about the courage that it takes to face your enemy when he has a gun and you don't. And I'm thinking back to, I think it was the Tolstoy lecture, when you talked about that the only way to break the cycle of evil is finally not to return the evil. And of course, that's basic Christian theology. And I think that's what the night about Tolstoy was about. Tolstoy was getting back to the basic words of Jesus, to love the enemy. But what really strikes me in this is, it sounds respecting the enemy, loving the enemy, it sounds very beautiful, but there's also the element of terror in that as well. Because just because you don't have a gun doesn't mean, and you have a lot of courage, and you're very humble, and you're loving your enemy, it still doesn't mean that the enemy isn't going to pull the trigger. And to me, that seems why, finally, all non-Christian secular movements towards disarmament are doomed to failure. And while they do good to help Christians raise our consciousnesses, finally, that we have to face as Christians that laying down our guns, loving the enemy, may very well mean we are going to suffer for it. And we may have to accept the possibility that resignation and suffering, while it's very simple and very beautiful, is also very terrible. And may have, I mean, I'm thinking back to, I mentioned the Passion the other night. Christ doesn't come before Pilate and have a consciousness-raising time of creative techniques, and he doesn't sit down and have a scenario for an image of peace. Finally, Christ faces resignation and suffering, and even though he faces it, and he's very courageous, and he's very respectful to his enemies, and he loves them, he finally does die. So I think maybe that's my statement why, as Christians, we may very well have to give up many of the things we love to finally love the things that are greater than those that we do love.
I would say that first, and in starting the story with Tolstoy as I did say it first. I'm not sure that we should understand that statement, though, in a defeatist way, as if always the only thing that will ever happen will be that the good people get crucified. No, there are times when there are cross-bearing kinds of stances that don't mean death, although they do mean suffering or renunciation or servanthood. There are creative situations where that readiness enables you to find a way through a situation without the ultimate sacrifice. So I don't think we want to decide ahead of time how hopeless a given act of Christian love is going to be. I would hesitate, secondly, to say that only Christians can see any of this. Obviously, it's simplest to see it if we are simple about Jesus and follow the faith of the New Testament in connecting what we say about being disciples of Jesus with what we do about violence. But a Buddhist can see it in other terms, a Gandhi can see it in other terms, only indirectly illuminated by Jesus. And some of these modern social scientists I'm talking about can see it in statistical terms. That violence is so counterproductive, even conventional violence, even good old clean war, was so counterproductive when you actually measure by what it was claiming to do. If you get away from the propaganda with which people tried to drum up the populace to be willing to fight a war, that the dysfunctional quality of war can be seen by just plain ordinary secular intelligence if you do some illuminating and debunking. That's not the same thing as Christian faith. But it moves away from glorifying violence to some degree. So that I'd rather be open to coalitions with secular intelligence than assume that all the time the intelligent secular thing to do would be have a war, and it's only us Christians that don't want war. No, war is never an intelligent secular thing to do either. And we owe it to the secular world to tell it that. So we can't grant that the realm of unbelief has the last word, even about nature and reason. But I would start with saying, as crucial, what you said first. I just wouldn't draw the polar attitudes towards other options from it that you might suggest. There.
One of the things that has always scared me, I think you talked about when you said the split between the tactics and the moral. And one of the things that I often hear Christian peacemakers saying is it sounds to me like you just lay down your guns, but then that's all. And so that is a defeatist attitude, it seems to me, rather than finding creative ways of using power, that power in itself is bad. And I've never seen power in itself to be bad, only when used in evil ways. And so it seems to me that some of the things that are stumbling blocks to people who resist the idea of non-violence is that it means just turning the other cheek and then waiting. And in this discussion, the most hopeful thing to me is the idea that we have to think of creative ways of solving conflict rather than just giving up when conflict arises.
I don't want to start a discussion about the word power because that is very complex just on the verbal level. I want to say yes and yet careful. And then I'll just repeat as a caution what was said before. I don't think even Tolstoy, who talked that way, really meant you just lay down your gun and do nothing. He actually mobilized people against the Russian government in various nonviolent ways. And I don't think that all that Jesus did was get himself crucified. He also started a movement of people who were restructuring their economy and restructuring their family style and everything else. Before he was put to death, although he was willing to go to death without resistance. So even at the points in the picture where it looks the most like just being passive, it wasn't passive. And very often it's appropriate and morally quite consistent to be much more aggressive. And since Gandhi and King, or one could even say since William Penn, one sees more and more ways to be socially constructive without violence, especially in the modern West, where we have pluralistic societies and democracy giving us all access to some portion of what goes on in society. So that more and more it isn't the way you described it, that Christian love of enemy means you do nothing. There are many things we can do, many things we must do, some things are already being done and we can join them. But I don't want to get into the kind of debate that will say that, therefore, the only justification of a peace position is that we can do all these positive things. No, it would be right in a situation where we couldn't do anything. It's right for Soviet evangelicals who can't do anything socially to be nonviolent. And some of them are. Baptists and Mennonites and Pentecostals who are pacifists in the Soviet Union, just because it says so in the Bible. They can't change society. They can't provide a nonviolent alternative, it's still right to reject violence. So I don't want to grant the rightness of rejecting violence is based on having always an adequate alternative. But I do want to agree with you that most of the time the rejection of violence doesn't mean passivity. At least one more question we have.
I didn't reflect at all, or I missed it earlier in the week, about the anti-war period.
No, there certainly would be. I was concentrating on persons. I mentioned King having to decide 2/3 of the way through his public career whether he would also speak to the Vietnam War or not, but I didn't speak of the anti-war movement itself as another case. It certainly would have been worth adding to the picture. I don't think we know how successful it was. It seems that Lyndon Johnson didn't run again because he had a growing sense that he was being rejected, and yet the end of the war was another 5 years after that. So it's very hard to say how much good that anti-war movement did, assuming that you think it's good to have an anti-war position. But certainly that whole study, that whole experience would have to be studied again. The thing it seems to me to show that's the most relevant to our ongoing discussion is not what pacifists can do. Because most of the anti-war people weren't pacifists. They didn't say all war was wrong. They didn't say the Korean War was wrong or the Hitler War was wrong. Just the Vietnam War was wrong. So what that experience means is a contribution to the revitalization of the just war tradition. That is, the people who say war is not always wrong, but sometimes wrong, said this is a wrong one, so we won't go. and the number of people that thought that way was a significant change in mentality in the American experience. And that is very worthy of attention. It came about Hiroshima, and now it comes about Vietnam. Some people say, even if all war is not wrong, this one is. So I'll say no at least here. And that was a new event in the American experience.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand, maybe I just don't have sufficient background, I didn't understand your illustration about Norway. Could you make that a little more clear to me? I understood the resistance movement in Norway to have been a violent one.
Well, there was violent resistance, which didn't do any good, but it didn't stop the Nazis.
Oh.
And there were people who worked with the British and did sabotage. But what it was that saved Norway was their ability to be Norwegians under the Germans and not their ability to fight at every village all the way up the country. Denmark was overwhelmed too fast to fight back at all, the Netherlands practically so. And all of those countries kept their identity. That's my only point. I didn't mean that there was no effort to be violently nationalistic, but they were swamped and were not successful. They lost a violent war so rapidly that it didn't have a chance to destroy them. But they maintained their identity on another level of integrity than fighting and winning a war against Hitler. And some of the most effective elements of that experience were explicitly nonviolent, especially a teacher strike that is often reported in the compendia of this kind of thing, in which a radical Nazification of the school curriculum was ordered by the collaborationist government, and the teachers just all refused, and with great success. In this case, the church was pretty strongly with them too. I think the Norwegian story is also partly in it is in the background of the Gene Sharp book that I referred to. One more short question, if there is one, or comment. Well, then go in peace.